and welcome to this podcast focusing on the treatment of HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Virginia Cocklemani, Antonio Giordano, Nadia Harbeck, and Sarah Sammons discuss the use of oral SERD-based therapy through a series of clinical cases. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Stemline Therapeutics, Inc. Dr. Giordano presents the first case regarding identifying acquired resistance and initiating oral SERD therapy.
So let's dive in the first case that we're going to discuss about identifying acquired resistance and initiating oral SERD therapy. So we have a 63-year-old postmenopausal woman with an HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer that was diagnosed 4 years after completing adjuvant endocrine therapy for early-stage disease. She now demonstrated progression after 22 months of first-line anastrozole plus ribociclib. NGS testing at the time of initial metastatic diagnosis did not identify actionable genomic alteration. She is clinically stable and asymptomatic with bone predominant metastatic disease.
So let's start here a discussion, right? So we have a patient who's 9 years post-diagnosis. She has metastatic disease. She's given first-line therapy with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, which lasts around the median of those 2 years that we typically expect from that CDK. And now she has disease progression. She initially had NGS testing. That didn't really show anything. What are you going to do after that? Are you going to repeat the NGS testing? What kind of testing are you going to do? She has bone-only disease. And walk me through how you would really see this patient and what you would discuss with them.
Sure. So the one of the most important thing to consider here is that, number one, the patient has been exposed to several years of aromatase inhibitors. So if we consider the adjuvant treatment plus several now months in the metastatic setting of exposure to aromatase inhibitor, it will increase the likelihood of finding some alteration in the ESR1 gene if NGS would be repeated. Number two, we would need to consider also a look at the site of disease, and we see that this patient has bone predominant metastatic disease that put also us in a condition that would not make repeating a tumor tissue biopsy being very easy, feasible from the clinical perspective. So I would consider this is a perfect candidate, for example, for repeating NGS and liquid biopsy. So analysis of ctDNA would be the preferred way to test such a patient. The other reason is also because we have seen that ctDNA is also more likely to detect an ESR1 mutation compared to NGS. And for that reason, I would think that this is a perfect candidate for ctDNA testing.
So this patient is 4 years after her adjuvant endocrine therapy. So we still think of her as an endocrine sensitive patient. But of course, you know, she has symptomatic bone lesions. We do a scan. She has metastatic disease. We need to re-biopsy. Check estrogen receptor, progesterone, HER2. I am sending next generation sequencing on estrogen sensitive, endocrine sensitive, and resistant patients, mostly just to have that data for the future. But for this patient, probably regardless of what I found, I would have started her on anastrozole and ribociclib.
Dr. Sammons presents the second case regarding selecting between oral SERD monotherapy and combination strategies.
So the same patient from case one is now being considered for oral SERD therapy. We ended up obtaining that liquid biopsy, which revealed a acquired ESR1 D538G mutation. And her oncologist is weighing whether monotherapy or a combination approach would be the most appropriate given her clinical status and her mutation profile.
So we have a lot of data here. And we have a lot of potential approvals, new approvals, and we also have new NCCN guidance that is not necessarily part of that approval process, at least yet. So what are you going to do?
So this patient is the optimal patient for oral SERD monotherapy. She's had 22 months on her first-line AI CDK4/6 inhibitor. So, you know, that's sort of past the 12-month mark that we learned from Emerald, and I think I have some of that data on the next slide. And not only that, she has bone-only progression. She's asymptomatic. So she's really the perfect candidate for oral SERD monotherapy. And so I do think that I would offer her oral SERD monotherapy. Of course, we have a brand new approval in the U.S. Of vepdegestrant, which is a PROTAC. So that could be an option as well. But I would probably lean towards a SERD just because I've been using it the longest.
So yeah, show us the data and then we can go over the discussion.
All right, so in terms of the approved agents that we have that target ESR1, we now have two oral SERDs and a PROTAC approved in the U.S. for ESR1 mutant hormone receptor positive HER2 negative advanced breast cancer after progression on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Of course, the first to market was elacestrant, approved over 3 years ago at this point, based off of the Emerald results, which was essentially elacestrant versus mostly fulvestrant. In the ESR1 mutant population, we saw a PFS of 3.8 versus 1.9 months. And then in a very pivotal subsequent analysis in the patients that had greater than 12 months on their first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor, we saw a median PFS of 8.6 versus 1.9 months. And in terms of, we also recently, actually not so recent, time is flying, September 2025, we received approval for imlunestrant for ESR1 mutant patients based off of the EMBER-3 clinical trial, which was a three-armed trial. But for now, we'll just look at the imlunestrant versus physician's choice endocrine therapy arms. In the ESR1 mutant population, we saw a median PFS of 5.5 versus 3.8 months. And there's a trend towards overall survival, which is not fully mature. Now, what's not really noted here is that these trial populations are extremely different. The elacestrant patients were much more heavily pretreated, all had received a prior CDK, whereas in EMBER-3, not all patients had a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. So very different patient populations. And then just a couple weeks ago, we received approval for vepdegestrant, which is a PROTAC estrogen receptor degrader in ESR1 mutant patients. So we do have technically three options now for monotherapy.
So let's hold off on the combinations yet. This is the first PROTAC, right, Antonio? Tell us a little bit about how excited you are about PROTACs in general and ER degrader PROTAC as well.
Yeah, so PROTAC molecule are the benefit or to be like independent from the presence of the estrogen in circulation and able to degrade completely the target, in this case, the estrogen receptor. And that's the beauty of oral SERD and PROTAC. It's because they completely are independent from the presence of the estradiol and the activation of the pathway. So when you have an ESR1 mutation in some of these spots that render the The protein, the estrogen receptor itself, activated without the dependence on the estradiol, you are able to overcome the mechanism of resistance. There is actually more, because we see also based on the recent data from Lidera in the adjuvant setting, that there might be additional benefit of using a product or SERD in ablating this pathway that is maybe independent from the presence of the mutation in the domain that is binding to the estradiol. I think a lot more needs to be done from the translational perspective to figure it out who are those patients and what are those mechanisms. But we definitely have seen this in the lab where taking away the estrogen receptor itself, the protein, will actually overcome some mechanism of resistance that are even independent from the mutation.
So were you surprised with VERITAC-2 that the improvement in activity was limited only in the ESR1 mutant subset?
No, because I think is that that's definitely the most frequent mechanism of resistance after exposure to aromatase inhibitor, and so I would expect to be the main driver of the benefit, and that's why I think in those three study we see that there is an increased hazard ratio and progression-free survival compared to the standard of care, most of which was fulvestrant, in the patient with a mutation. We have to remember that fulvestrant is a poor bioavailable drug, and even with the double injection and a booster after 2 weeks, really we cannot reach the amount of degradation of the estrogen receptor that is enough to overcome the resistance to a mutation.
And that's a great point. I mean, the reason for developing all of these oral SERDs is the fact that we cannot get to the full dose of fulvestrant that we would need. And with having an oral agent, you can push the dose up as much as you want to and therefore get more degradation of the ER. Nadia, how does ESMO look at these three agents? Vectibeg is not approved yet in Europe, but likely, you know, will get approved soon. Is there a differentiation between those three, or do you kind of consider them all similar?
Fulvestrant isn't such a bad drug with all its shortcomings and so forth. It's a good drug, and we were quite happy to have it. Now we have better drugs. But so probably in the ESR1 mutated population, you just tease out this difference in activity more than you do in the general population.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. Sarah, you want to go over the combination data?
Yes, absolutely. So we now also have two phase three trials that have looked at oral SERD combination strategies, the first being EMBER-3. EMBER-3 had three arms. It had physician's choice endocrine therapy. It had imlunestrant monotherapy and imlunestrant abemaciclib. And imlunestrant abemaciclib versus imlunestrant alone were compared, showing a median PFS of 9.4 versus 5.5 months. In the patients that had previous CDK4/6 inhibitors, the median PFS was 9.1 versus 3.7 months. And in the ESR1 mutant subgroup, it was 11.1 versus 5.5 months. Now, there's certainly some tolerability considerations with the doublet, any grade diarrhea being 86% for the combination of abema and imlunestrant. And then we've also, in the last year, seen data for Avera, which is giredestrant plus everolimus, versus standard of care endocrine therapy versus everolimus. And this was a positive study, median PFS being 8.7 versus 5.5 months. But it really shined a bit more in the ESR1 mutant population, which is the theme that we've been seeing, median PFS of 9.9 versus 5.4 months. And they showed a post-hoc analysis where they took out the non-ESR1 mutant patients, And there really actually didn't seem to be much of a benefit. So I do think that most of the benefit here is being driven by the ESR1 mutant patients. Then, of course, for any doublet, you're adding toxicity. So we see some stomatitis, some mild GI side effects. But for the patient that we discussed, she is not somebody that I think a combination would be necessary for, due to all of the reasons that we discussed. So we have also seen data for the phase 2 ELEVATE study, which took patients with estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer with 1 to 2 lines of prior endocrine therapy with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Prior fulvestrant was allowed. Primary endocrine resistance was allowed. No prior chemo. Now, these people did have to have greater than or equal to 1 measurable lesion by RECIST, or they could have a mainly lytic bone lesion. And so this is a multi-arm phase 2 study of elacestrant, really combined with all of the targeted therapeutics that we use in the post-CDK4/6 space, alpelisib, everolimus, palbociclib, ribociclib, and capivasertib. And so we've seen data now for elacestrant plus everolimus, and elacestrant plus abemaciclib, as well as at this meeting, we will see elacestrant plus capivasertib. And so I can show you the data now for elacestrant and everolimus and elacestrant and abemaciclib. In terms of elacestrant and everolimus, 50 patients were treated. In terms of the number that had prior visceral disease, it's over half. In terms of whether or not they had ESR1 mutations, there was good representation for both ESR1 mutant and ESR1 wild type, as well as PIK3CA mutant and wild type. So to go back to the original question, in these trials, patients could be ESR1 mutant or wild type. For elacestrant and everolimus, we see a median progression-free survival of 8.3 months, an overall response rate of about 20%. For elacestrant and abemaciclib, we see a median progression-free survival of 14.3 months, an overall response rate of 24.6 months. And I don't see it listed here, but not all patients had a CDK4/6 inhibitor. I want to say somewhere between 60 and 70% of patients had a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, which is worth noting.
So one of the questions here that we tried to answer initially was whether the benefit was only in one subgroup of patients or the other. And we're going to have data for the abemaciclib cohort, but for the everolimus cohort, it looked like it really didn't make a difference whether somebody was ESR1, had an ESR1 mutated or wild-type disease, which is nice to see. So based on that data, anything that you would do differently, would you? Now, there's another thing that's important. The dose for everolimus here was 7.5 milligrams, whereas with the Evera trial, it was 10 milligrams. Mm-hmm. And this really highlights, and Antonio, how important the initial phase 1 work is. It highlights that we should really not be combining agents that we don't have data on.
Absolutely.
And we have everolimus now data with 10 milligrams, 7.5, 5. People use it any way they want to. But unless we generate safety data, we shouldn't just all say, well, you know, it's an oral agent. We can just combine it with anything. That's really an issue, right?
That's really important. That's why phase 1 study are the most important studies.
Yes.
Totally. And you know, we do that actually in the clinical practice. We do most of the time do not start patient on 10 milligram of everolimus. Even for standard of care, we try to taper up the dose. We start with a reduced dose to see how they tolerate. This has to also place in the context of an umbrella study where it would be very cumbersome and lengthy to incorporate a phase one portion. So the study that allow there was actually I feel like a very smart decision to actually start with a lower dose. When you are using two drugs that seems to be synergized and work on a mechanism of resistance, it is super smart to like reduce the dose of both drugs so you can mitigate the tolerability of the combination.
Nadia, how does it work in Europe? If you have phase two clinical data with activity and you have two approved agents, let's say everolimus and elacestrant or abemaciclib and elacestrant, are you free to use them as in combination, or do you have to go with just the approvals per agent?
We're not free to use them, but I think Elevate is a great program because it gives us sort of safety and a glimpse at efficacy. And if you put that next to the larger phase three trials, you see it actually not that much different. So there is a principle there. It works and it's safe to combine. And I think we cannot possibly have phase three trials. Now, with all these different agents, we're lacking evidence for the line of therapy as well as combinations. How can we possibly do this in phase three trials? And if we were able to do that, I think there's more burning questions like new agents coming along. And I think this is a very smart way of doing that. Having said that, it's guideline informing, that's for sure. And we update our guidelines in Germany, for example, every year. So we can put that in. But it depends on the country. Some countries like the UK are very strict. They follow the label letter by letter, word by word. In Germany, you have a little bit more flexibility, you know. And then the patient has a contraindication against another agent. They have to use one of these modern combinations or something like that. So we're more flexible. I understand the US, it's the same. Once you have safety and efficacy data, you're a bit more flexible.
So, Sarah, you mentioned something before when we were talking about combination and single agent, and you mentioned response rate. Now, when we look at these curves, right, in those single agent studies versus the combinations, there's a big drop initially with those single agent studies in the progression-free survival, whereas there isn't as much in the combination. Can you comment on that and what that really shows you when you're trying to think of who you're going to use which approach?
Sure. I think if you look at the SERD monotherapy studies, there's sort of a very quick initial drop in, 40 to 50% of the patients that simply just are not benefiting from endocrine monotherapy. And that's alleviated somewhat in the combination studies. Simply because, like I said before, resistance mechanisms post CDK4/6 are multifaceted. They're not simply in most patients based on an ESR1 mutation. And so when you're hitting multiple pathways, you'll get less of a drop-off and more patients will benefit. And I think it's our task in the clinic to just figure out who are those patients that are going to have the most benefit from SERD monotherapy, because without a doubt, it's the best tolerated. Patients love being on SERD monotherapy. They feel great on it. And it's just trying to figure out who those are. For now, it's the ESR1 mutant patients who've had more than 12 months on their CDK4/6. But it would be nice if we could get a little bit more elegant about that selection.
Dr. Harbeck presents the third case regarding the role of ctDNA surveillance and early intervention.
It's a 48-year-old postmenopausal woman, HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, and she's been on first-line letrozole plus palbociclib for 18 months with stable disease. And she has read about these blood tests to detect resistance mutations and asked whether she should have ctDNA monitoring to potentially change treatments earlier. So the question is ctDNA surveillance for ESR1 mutations? Everybody knows the SERENA-6 study. It's an interesting study. I think it's quite a daring study as a registrational strategy, and there is a lot of controversy we can discuss. ODAC first said no, then they said maybe. The European Commission immediately said yes. There is a positive opinion now, which takes about six weeks or so till we until we have the approval. So I think the SERENA-6 study is complicated from a clinical point of view because it's mixing two things. One is a registrational study for a new drug, a new oral SERD. The other one is a new principle of care, whether we should actually act on molecular progression and not just on, like Sarah said, radiological progression. So, I mean, the study itself, it took patients after AI plus CDK4/6 at initial therapy, and patients had to be stable on that for at least 6 months, and then they started to monitor with liquid biopsies for ESR1 mutations, and then patients were randomized for camizestrant plus continuing the CDK4/6 plus placebo for AI versus continuing the AI plus CDK4/6 and the placebo for camizestrant. The primary endpoint is PFS by investigator assessment. And if you look at the dynamics of the trial from the screening to the randomization, we can see that about 10% of the patients that were screened were actually randomized, and they screened over 3,000, and they found patients, mostly half of them on the first screening and the rest on the subsequent screenings, 500 and plus patients, and then they had to exclude some because when they actually checked, they also had radiological progression. So it's a very large screening strategy for finding a few patients there. And then obviously the data are quite intriguing. They showed us a substantial, significant, and also I think clinically meaningful improvement in progression-free survival, about 7 months difference here. And also if they looked at the PFS2, they showed a very large difference there as well.
Dr. Giordano presents the last case regarding managing dual resistance pathways.
Antonio, last case.
So let's complicate a little bit the case and add another mutation. So this is a 48-year-old premenopausal woman with obesity, a newly diagnosed de novo HR-positive HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer that initiated first-line palbociclib plus letrozole with ovarian suppression. She experienced disease progression after approximately 20 months of therapy. At initial diagnosis, NGS identified on tumor a PIK3CA E545K mutation, so helical domain. Repeat plasma-based testing at progression reveals a newly acquired ESR1 Y537S mutation. So we're going to see this case with two different scenarios. That is scenario one. The patient has bone predominant metastatic disease, and a scenario two, in a patient that has liver metastasis with progression of disease in the liver with normal AST and ALT. So, but let's go back and talk about double mutation. So from this retrospective analysis and of the EMBER-3, when they looked at the population with PIK3CA mutation, regardless of ESR1 mutation, we noticed that number one on the left side, you can see it's very small, but the last part of the forest plot, the last two lines, are patient with or without the mutation. And you can see that the benefit of the combination of imulanestrant with abemaciclib was maintained for wild type and mutated. And on the right, you can see the median progression-free survival of the patient with the PIK3CA mutation. You notice that overall, this patient, they do carry a poorer prognosis compared to the patient without the mutation. And you can see that in the presence of a double mutation, it almost looks like the doublet has an advantage compared to single agent monotherapy SERD. And from the EMERALD, we saw similarly on the right a preclinical model that we're not going to review, but among patients with PIK3CA and ESR1 mutated tumors, the median progression-free survival was 5.5 months with elacestrant single agent and 1.9 months with standard of care. So even here, a single agent elacestrant seems to make a difference when compared with the standard of care endocrine therapy. And those are actually data from real-world retrospective analysis of NGS from the Flatiron study in this left bottom corner in coexisting ESR1 and PIK3CA mutation, treatment to time to next treatment with elacestrant, the single agent, was about 6.3 months. So we do notice that when there are double mutation, the median progression-free survival tend to be lower than in the absence of PIK3CA mutation, but still the oral SERD has the potential of achieving a median progression-free survival that is more than 4 months.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.